This morning, in this part of the program, we'll be doing our regular Talk to the Family Doctor program, and our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here. We do these shows to give you the opportunity to ask about just about anything. We do occasionally have specialists on the show who deal with different areas, like old children's health, for example. In fact, we're going to be doing that this week. Dr. Robert Bocek will be here on Thursday. But on these programs, we say, well, we want to open it up so that whatever concerns you might have could be for your kids, actually, because Dr. Jeff does indeed see children in his practice, but also adults. And whatever's on your mind, if it has to do with your health, someone close to you, if you have questions, they are certainly welcome, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. All you need to do is call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL or 9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call at any point here. If you have questions, you can do that. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
Just recently, I guess I saw some continuing kind of controversy or disagreement about chickenpox vaccine. The state of Illinois has decided not to add that to the list of things that you have to have when
To get into school.
To get into school, right. Yes. There seems to be because I've talked about this a lot with Dr. Bocek, within pediatrics, what he always says is if the parents come in and say they want it, he'll say fine. If they say they don't want it, he'll say fine. It kind of leaves that up to the parents. And I wonder what your feeling about it is. I mean, is it something that you recommend?
It's one of those things that's available, and because it's not required for school, you can basically have the conversation with the parents that there are some potential advantages to it. There's also theoretically some potential downside to it. Most people regard chickenpox as a very benign childhood disease, and for the vast majority of children, it's sort of a rite of passage that us of a certain age all went through. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the fact that there are, hundreds of thousands of cases, there's always the rare individual who does develop one of the known serious side effects of chickenpox. You can develop a particularly nasty form of pneumonia due to chickenpox. You can develop a form of encephalitis from chickenpox. And every year, there are a few children who are actually significantly medically harmed and a few deaths directly attributable to chickenpox. So the vast majority of children don't have those problems, but there are a few who do. And some of that can probably either be prevented or significantly reduced if they were all immunized. The immunization itself seems to be fairly effective. It seems to be safe. There haven't been any reported serious side effects related to it. The major unanswered question is whether or not it's going to be protective lifelong. And it may turn out to be something that you never need to have again and that you'll have lifelong immunity. It may turn out to be something more like the tetanus immunization where every 10 years you need a booster in order to keep your immunity up. The studies related to how long the chickenpox vaccination is effective simply haven't gone out far enough yet for anybody to say that, yes, it's protective lifelong. It's been used overseas a number of years before it was available here, and to date, I'm not aware of any recommendations for a booster or re-immunizing yet, and I think those studies are out about 20 years now. So the Illinois Department of Health basically said that we're not going to require it for entrance into school because it's not that big a problem in the school setting, but basically left it as an option for parents to discuss with their individual physicians.
Hmm. All right. We got a caller here. Others are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle Clinic. He's a family practice doctor. He's with us every other month, and we do these open-ended sort of shows about health care. So whatever questions you have, you can call us, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am a male, 87 years old, and I have two questions. Maybe you can have a suggestion on one or both or either way. Sleep is a problem for an 87-year-old, except for aspirin PM. It's a little slow, and I'd like to get a little more sleep. The other question is getting up in the morning, a dizziness, which is kind of makes one wobbly for a while until I shake my head around and do a little walking or exercise to get the rapid heartbeat and the dizziness out of my head. Any suggestions, doctor?
Are you taking any medications currently, sir?
Just for diabetes.
And that's an oral medication, not insulin?
No, oral medication.
Oral medication. The difficulty you describe with sleep is sometimes actually fairly common in older individuals, because it's generally felt that the sleep requirements do decrease somewhat with age. And individuals may indeed not need as much sleep as they did before. I think one of the key things to look at relative to your sleep is whether you awaken refreshed the next morning or not. If you are fatigued the next morning, the quantity and quality of your sleep is probably not adequate. On the other hand, if you're simply sleeping less but able to function perfectly well the next day, it may not be a medical problem. There are individuals who have trouble falling asleep. There are folks who have trouble staying asleep. And there are folks who have their sleep interrupted by other medical concerns. Men, not uncommonly, get up in the middle of the night to empty their bladder. That's a fairly common symptom related to their prostate. And if you're getting up five or six times at night to do that, that can significantly impact the quality of your sleep.
Five or six times?
Or, you know, whatever that number is.
Yeah.
The other entity that can interrupt sleep at night for men and women, though it's more common in men, is what's referred to as obstructive sleep apnea. This is the individual who snores loudly and also then stops breathing. This significantly interrupts their quality and quantity of sleep as well, leaving them...
What's a good average number of hours for an 87-year-old?
Well, that actually varies by individual, but it would not be uncommon to see you only need 6 to 7 hours of sleep.
Six or seven.
Right.
Okay. The next one.
The dizziness is probably sort of multifactorial in its origin. Age in and of itself will cause your blood vessels to sort of become stiffer, and this, quote, hardening of the arteries makes it more difficult to regulate your blood pressure when you change position. And after you've been down all night and then get up first thing in the morning, there are indeed individuals who are dizzy and lightheaded because of that change in position. That tendency tends to be aggravated in diabetic patients who, over a long period of time, start to have neurological changes.
I didn't hear that, doctor. Could you speak up just a little louder, please?
Problem tends to be aggravated in diabetic patients who tend to develop what's called autonomic neuropathy, and they have more difficulty regulating their blood pressure. But there are several things that can be done to minimize that, and one, the single most important thing is to make sure that you change your position slowly.
Get up slowly.
Right, and not try and sort of bound out of bed, because you will indeed be lightheaded, and the major risk would be fall.
The major risk would be a fall?
Correct.
Yes, yes, I almost did that. Wow. And that's it? Just to wait for the rapid heartbeat to settle down?
Well, that part of things needs to be further evaluated by your regular doctor, in the sense that there isn't any way to tell what type of heart rhythm you're having at that time without doing some extra studies, either listening to your heart or doing an electrocardiogram. So,
the fact that it settles down after a while?
Well, it would still need to be checked to make sure that it's not a manifestation of any separate underlying heart problem. So
sure
if you,
enough, I'm about due for an exam anyway.
Well, this would be a good time to mention that to your physician.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Let's go on to another caller on our toll-free line in Colfax on line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was wondering. I have the bone disease, and I'm on Fosamax. And I wonder, can you get too much calcium? My doctor says no, but I read in the medical books we have that you can get too much calcium.
By bone disease, do you mean osteoporosis?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fosamax is a medication to help your body build new bone. In order for your body to do that, there has to be an adequate supply of calcium because
well, I have either two or three glasses of milk a day, and if I don't get three, I drink one glass of calcium-enriched orange juice, and I eat total breakfast food, which is supposed to have your daily requirement. I don't know if it does. And sometimes I take a Tums.
Okay. It sounds to me like in terms of your dietary intake, you're taking in a perfectly adequate amount of calcium, usually two or three dairy servings or some other food that has been supplemented with calcium is quite appropriate. The individuals who, for whatever reason, are lacking in calcium in their diet can indeed take a calcium supplement. Tums, which is an over-the-counter antacid, is primarily calcium carbonate and actually provides a fair amount of calcium in and of itself. But your question about can you take in too much is, the answer is yes, you can, especially if you don't take it with enough water. Extra calcium in your system can lead to things like kidney stones, and that's a problem for individuals who have that tendency.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wondered. I've been on this for 2 years, and my, you know, the bones are getting better, but I just was kind of wondered about that when I read that in that medical book.
From what you describe, I think the amount that you're taking in is quite appropriate.
I didn't know if that medical book meant that it's the supplements that you take, you know, that they may be the problem, and which I don't hardly take any. You know, I might take one Tums every other day or something like that. So
you're usually trying to get somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1,500 milligrams of calcium.
And according to my doctor, he says usually you get 500 from your other sources of what you eat during the day.
Right.
So, okay, I was just wondering about it. You know, I didn't want to get too much here. And because it said that's just as bad as not getting enough.
Well, I think you're doing fine.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Other questions are welcome. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic. And this is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is it can be anything that you want to ask about, you can do. He's here every other month. It's always on a Monday. And if you have questions, you can call us. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL.
I'd like to follow up on that lady's topic of osteoporosis just a minute, David.
Sure.
This is a fairly common problem, especially for women who have gone past menopause. There is a rapid decline in bone loss with menopause, and there are a number of things that women can do to help mitigate the problems that come as a result of the osteoporosis. Basically, in the premenopausal years, building up an adequate supply of strong bone is recommended, and maintaining that thereafter is important as well. But weight-bearing exercise, walking, jogging, something where you physically put pressure on the legs and spine helps stimulate the body to build more bone. And if you have an adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D, you'll probably be able to build a significant amount of bone mass. Then after menopause, you'd like to try and maintain that. And in many instances, estrogen replacement after menopause, both for the menopausal symptoms, but also to help prevent the loss of bone that comes at that time is useful. In individuals who, despite all of their best efforts at prevention, are found to be significantly thin in terms of their bones, then medications such as she mentioned can be added as well to try and maintain the integrity of the bone. The major problem here is that in older individuals, if they fall and break a hip, the hip itself can be, you know, pinned or replaced, but there are significant amounts of medical morbidity and mortality associated with that. And the pneumonias and the pulmonary emboli, the problems that come when people break their hip are significant. And this is a very common problem in the elderly. But the prevention of it needs to start years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's a good idea at some point, and what point would that be, for women to have a screening to determine the health, the adequacy of their bones?
This is a subject that's sort of being hotly debated right now as to who are the individuals that specifically need to be tested for the integrity of their bone. Certainly anybody who's had a family history of osteoporosis is at risk. The body builds that are most prone to this are the sort of small, thin, frail kind of individuals. People of Nordic descent seem to have more of a problem, and that's just an ethnic characteristic. Smokers have a much higher risk of this particular problem. Certainly anybody who's had any difficulty with a sort of an unexplained fracture or had a fracture due to relatively minor trauma is going to be at risk. There are some groups that are proposing just sort of universal screening. The vast majority of women are probably going to be fine, at least initially. The question then becomes, well, how often are you going to need to rescreen later? And I think the answers to that are still really being investigated.
We have someone else to talk with here. Caller in Peoria, line 4.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I got an article where it says the people that drink soda pop, it softens the bones. Do you believe that?
Soda pop contains phosphorus, and those phosphorus compounds often bind with calcium and prevent the calcium from being absorbed into the body to then be used for building bone. So it is possible for soda pop in that sense to interfere with calcium metabolism, and that could have, in the long run, some effect on the ability to replace and build new bone.
There's also 7 spoons full of sugar in a soda pop.
Which most of us don't need.
I mean, I see in a lot of these schools they have soda pop machines for the children that go to school, and I don't think it's a good idea.
Well, there certainly are better choices than that. I would agree with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Just to stay just for a second with the issue about the phosphorus in soda and the fact that that may get in the way of your calcium uptake, isn't this not one of those cases where you'd have to drink an awful lot of soda to actually see for there to be a problem?
In most instances, yes.
Okay.
The person who has, you know, 1 or 2 sodas a day is probably not at significant risk of interfering with their calcium metabolism, though some individuals who are prone to kidney stones need to be careful about that, because that's sometimes just enough to tip them over, because that ultimately gets excreted out through the urine.
Okay. And does any carbonated beverage have a lot of phosphorus in it?
Yeah.
So even carbonated, if you like bottled water that's carbonated, even that, does that have phosphorus?
It depends on the process that's used. You'd have to look fairly close at the label, but some of those, yes, do indeed have phosphorus compounds in them.
Okay. To Urbana, next, line 1. Hello.
Yes, I have had problem with middle back pain when I wake up in the morning. Sometimes it gets me out of bed. It's so painful, but then once I get going and throughout in the early morning, it goes away. And I've tried some stretching exercises. I do some swimming a couple of times a week. I'm wondering if this could be a pinched nerve, if I need to have an MRI, or what could be a possible cause for this strange problem.
How long has this been going on?
About 6 months.
Most mechanical back strains, you know, you bent over and lifted something or strained your back, should have spontaneously subsided by now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're beyond the point where you can just say, well, I'm going to wait and see if it goes away.
That sounds like a good plan.
So this is a situation where seeing your physician for more of a history and a physical exam is certainly, I think, very indicated here. Your question about, you know, do I need labs, x-rays, tests, and such would be dependent on what's found at the time of your physical exam. But in most instances, when people refer to a pinched nerve or ruptured disc, what we're usually talking about are the physical symptoms that accompany the pressure on the nerve as it runs down into the leg. And in those particular settings, most individuals complain more about pain in their leg than in their back, though they do have back discomfort. They often complain of numbness and tingling radiating down into the leg, and over a long period of time, it can actually make the leg weaker.
Mm-hmm.
Now, individuals who say, I'm having back discomfort and I'm having trouble controlling my bowels and my bladder, that's a very serious problem because that indicates a spinal cord problem.
Right.
But in most instances, sophisticated testing like MRI are primarily utilized by the surgeon who's planning your back surgery.
Okay.
They're usually not first-line tests necessary to determine the nature of what your back trouble is, unless there's serious contemplation that you have a ruptured disc or pinched nerve that's going to require surgery.
Okay.
I think at 6 months, you've probably put up with it longer than most would have, and it's probably time to go get it checked out.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And on to a Champagne person here, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I've got a question about stomach acid. I have a terrible time with stomach acid, and I'm taking some of those very expensive prescription pills twice a day, and I drink Gaviscon by the bottle, and so I have trouble with stomach acid, which isn't necessarily related to what I eat, although sometimes it may be related to some medicine I take. But my question is, what causes, you know, this overproduction of the stomach acid, and does it ever correct itself?
Well, you've asked a question that I think plagues millions of Americans. And sort of short answer is you're either born with a tendency toward it or your lifestyle promotes problems with stomach acid. Acid in the stomach is usually not a problem because your stomach was designed to hold acid. That's where a major part of your digestive process takes place. The problem becomes when there truly is excess acid that your stomach can't handle, or what is actually more common is some of that acid gets out of the stomach up into your esophagus, which is at the lower part of your chest. In those particular settings, people try and self-medicate either with an antacid, something to neutralize the acid, or medications that actually help prevent your body from producing extra acid. The initial medications are called H2 blockers. That's your Tagamet, Pepcid, Zantac kind of medication. And what you may be referring to in terms of the newer, more expensive medications are referred to as proton pump inhibitors, and this is your Prilosec, Prevacid type medications, which work by a different mechanism to help your body produce less acid. But in many instances, we don't know why people produce more, but it's often in response to their diet, and there are a fair number of things that you can do to sort of minimize the irritation to your stomach. And some of the biggies that we know are a problem, caffeine is a problem, nicotine is a problem, alcohol is definitely a problem, and a number of, as you say, over-the-counter medications, primarily your anti-inflammatory agents, the aspirin, ibuprofen-type medications can be quite irritating to the stomach. So those are some...
If I'm not having any of those,
mm-hmm. If you're not having any of those,
yeah,
and you're still having trouble,
yeah,
it may indeed be time to look seriously at whether there's underlying ulcer disease present. Ulcer disease in the last few years has been shown to not be a problem of only excess stomach acid, but it's thought to be also due to a process where bacteria get into the lining of the stomach and actually cause a problem. The particular bacteria is referred to as H. pylori, and there are several different ways to test for the presence of this bacteria. If it is present, then eradicating the bacteria with antibiotics will, in many instances, significantly reduce ulcer symptoms and actually prevent it from coming back. So this is something that needs to be thought about.
Strange thing is, I had an endoscopy in June, and things got really bad after the endoscopy, but the doctor seems to think, well, you know, everything was fine, so there shouldn't be anything wrong.
Was a biopsy for H. pylori done at that time?
I don't know.
Normally, if you've gotten to the point where endoscopy is done, they would typically include that as part of your testing. And that's what I was going to say next, is if your H. pylori is negative to begin with and you're still having trouble, then the next step usually is endoscopy, a procedure where a lighted instrument is placed down inside through the esophagus into the stomach to look around and see if there's any physical reason in there to indicate a problem. Now, in rare instances, there are people who have gastrin-producing tumors. And gastrin is a substance that the body normally makes in small quantities to stimulate acid, and occasionally somebody will actually produce more of this substance than they're supposed to. And again, there's a test for that. But if you're still,
they would have seen that if they did an endoscopy.
They should have, yes.
But the endoscopy itself have irritated my stomach so much that I have trouble?
No, there really isn't anything about the procedure itself that should cause you any trouble.
I guess I should see my doctor.
I think it's time to go back and talk to him again. In some instances, if people are having trouble primarily with the acid getting back up into the esophagus, what we refer to as gastroesophageal reflux, and their symptoms aren't controlled with just medication, they may indeed be surgical candidates to try and close off the connection between their esophagus and their stomach to try and minimize acid from getting back up there.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Other questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel. You can use that, and that's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. If you have questions, our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor from Carle Clinic. Just, I'm thinking about going back to the first caller who called in, the gentleman who said he was having trouble sleeping. And one of the things that you talked about was the fact that, well, something for men, particularly once you get to a particular age that can maybe interrupt your sleep, is if you have prostate enlargement, and that you may then feel that you have to get up frequently during the night to urinate. And I guess one of the things we know is that men, as they get older, everybody's going to have some enlargement of the prostate, which is not certainly not indicative of cancer. It just seems to be something that happens and
correct,
that also is treatable.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder when, you know, at what point you start, how you decide whether a guy has a problem, and then when you start thinking about treatment, because there are medications that can be used.
And there are surgical procedures that can also be used as well. The problem of what's referred to as BPH, or benign prostatic hyperplasia, refers to the normal sort of age-expected increase in size of the prostate that, as you very correctly point out, almost all men have some symptoms of as they get older. The prostate, as it enlarges, puts some physical pressure against the bladder, which sort of stimulates it. It feels like it needs to empty again. So nocturia, getting up to urinate at night, is a fairly common symptom associated with BPH. And other symptoms are that urge to go a little bit more frequently, needing to empty your bladder, but seemingly in smaller quantities, the force of the stream and the caliber of the stream may actually be reduced because, again, of physical obstruction by the prostate as the bladder tries to empty. As long as the examination and testing of the prostate itself reveals a benign condition, and the major thing to try and separate out here, is there a growth in the prostate that's suspicious for cancer? That will typically feel different on physical examination to the physician. And if there's any tendency toward prostate cancer in the family, the additional test that can be done to help try and exclude prostate cancer is a blood test referred to as the prostatic specific antigen or PSA test. And so a combination of the physical examination of the prostate and the PSA will usually allow the physician to reassure the patient that no, they don't have any evidence of malignant disease in their prostate. And at that point, the patient simply needs to decide, how bad do my symptoms bother me, and what am I willing to do about it? If they say, gee, this really is a major annoyance to me and I'm willing to take medication, that's a very reasonable thing to try. And there are several different types of medication that are available to help minimize the symptoms. They don't actually seem to change the physical size of the prostate, but they do tend to relax some of the physical obstructive symptoms, making the pattern of urination a little easier to live with. In individuals who either don't respond to the medication or don't tolerate the medication as well, surgical procedures to actually physically reduce the volume of the prostate are available, and probably remains the sort of the gold standard against which everything else is compared. But in that particular setting, that would be regarded as elective surgery in the sense that you decide when it bothers you enough that you want to undergo the procedure. As long as there's no evidence of complete physical obstruction, the surgery is basically at the discretion of the patient and their concern about their symptoms. Now, if somebody's prostate gets so big that they actually physically obstruct the complete emptying of their urinary tract, then that's basically you got to have something done because back pressure from your bladder up the ureters into the kidney can actually cause kidney damage. And that's not something that your body's going to put up with for any length of time.
Mm-hmm. So partly it's a matter of, as far as patient is concerned, you got to talk about, well, is this really a problem for you? And then if you're at that point, assuming that the physician doesn't feel strongly it's a problem and the patient doesn't, but if the patient, you know, says, well, this is, you know, kind of inconvenient, then you start in with what is the least invasive kind of thing that you could do, which would be to start with some medication.
Usually.
Yeah. There is an over-the-counter herbal, quote-unquote, product that I know some people have said they think works, this stuff called saw palmetto.
Right.
And I also, I guess, in what I have read about it, there seems to be within medical community, they're not really sure that I know that there are people anecdotally would probably tell you, oh, yes, I took this stuff and it was great. But then a lot of doctors would say, we really don't have any good indications that, in fact, this does anything.
This is actually an area that is being looked at, and at least some of the preliminary data suggests that it may indeed have a mild positive effect, though not in all individuals, because the supplement itself is considered to be non-toxic. It doesn't appear to interfere with other medications. It falls into a category where I personally don't think it's unreasonable for somebody, you know, if they say, well, gee, can I take this instead of another prescription medication? I don't think it's unreasonable. Usually they need to take it for several months in order to assess whether it's going to be useful or not. If it is, they can continue it. If it doesn't, then I don't think there's any point in continuing it, and then they can simply try some other medication.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left. Certainly time for other questions. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's family practice doctor from Carl Clinic. And if you have questions about health, yours, your children, family members, it's wide open, whatever's on your mind. He deals with a lot of different sorts of things in his practice. Doesn't have to be something that we've talked about already can be a completely new subject. But if you have a concern, you just like to talk about it with a doctor, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line. And so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Here's some other folks. We'll go to Chicago next, line four. Hello.
Yes, regarding gout, is there a test that can make a determination if a person has gout? And the next question would be, if it's a test, a simple procedure, and can you learn the results very quickly?
To answer your question briefly, the answer is yes. Gout is an inflammatory condition in the joints.
Yeah, in the joints, it's toes, yeah, on the feet.
Typically, the first big toe is the classic site that shows up in. And this is associated with an elevated level of a substance called uric acid in your system, which is often an inherited tendency. But it's a relatively straightforward blood test that your physician can order for you.
And would the indication mean that, as I heard, that it indicates either your inability to excrete the uric acid, whatever it is, the buildup of the uric acid crystal formation, or some kind of matter of overproduction or something like that?
Correct. You're either making a little bit more uric acid than you really need to, or you're having a little bit more trouble getting rid of it. But in either instance, you're allowing a sort of overaccumulation of it in your system, and then the excess ends up getting deposited in crystalline form into a joint, and the crystals are quite irritating to the joint.
The thing I'm concerned then, if it is that, would the recommendation be either to change the diet or take an appropriate medication to deal with the overproduction or lack of elimination, but which would be preferable, or both?
Either or both, depending on, there are ways to test for production and elimination of uric acid. There are some small dietary changes that may make a difference, but that's generally not the primary cause for it. Remaining adequately hydrated is indeed important because...
Well, that leads to my next question. Taking Lasix... see, I'm calling for a friend of mine, and he's just shy about it, talking on the phone. they have a high blood pressure, and this gout buildup apparently is a byproduct of their lifestyle. They are now up to like 120 measurements of the Lasix that it takes 340 units a day. Now, he forgot to ask the doctor how much water should a person be taking if you're having Lasix, which eliminates so much water.
Right.
So what would you think would be, should they take the full 6 to 8 glasses or more when you mentioned hydrate in relation to uric acid and all that?
That's going to depend on the condition for which he's taking the Lasix. That's probably going to need to be answered by his personal physician. There are times when we try and
keep up that full load of water intake, or should they, since you're trying to eliminate so much water due to a buildup of in the legs and that, should they be still continuing to take in a large amount of water to keep hydrated?
Normally, the 6 to 8 glasses of water that are recommended would still be appropriate here.
That'd be the minimum, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to, we have somebody here in Danville or around Danville calling from a car phone on line two. Hello.
Good morning, Doctor.
Yeah. Good morning.
I have a question. About a year ago, well, it was February year 2000, I hit my funny bone, I hit my crazy bone on a filing cabinet, and I didn't think anything of it, and it, you know how you do that, it makes your arm go numb and rubbery. Well, the pain hasn't gone away yet.
And how long has it been now?
February year 2000.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I went to a PA, and he told me that maybe it was just tennis elbow, and it could take up to 2 years to go away. So I decided to scrap that idea, and I'm going to go see a doctor tomorrow morning. But what kind of questions should I be asking? Should we do an X-ray, or have I maybe broken a bone or something, or have I pinched a nerve, or, you know, when you hit your, whenever you do something like that off handedly. It's like all your body force is in it. It's like stubbing your toe or something.
Right. Normally, the nerve that runs through the groove of your elbow down into your forearm and your hand, if you bump it directly, stimulates it, and you do get that numb, tingly, painful sensation. But even in situations where you've traumatized it fairly significantly, we would normally expect that to go away in 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, well, it hasn't.
So, if you're still having symptoms that are radiating down into your forearm and hand, it's time to look for some type of ongoing compression of that nerve. And excluding a bony injury is certainly reasonable. An X-ray of your elbow would be appropriate. It may be necessary to do some specific testing of the nerve itself. What's referred to as an EMG or nerve conduction velocity test may be something that you want to talk to your physician about.
EMG?
EMG. Mm-hmm. It stands for electromyogram.
Okay.
And the other half of that is the nerve conduction velocity test. And this can often pinpoint where and how badly a nerve is being compressed.
Hmm. Is it going to be a big deal if it is? That would be a pinched nerve. Is that going to be a big deal? Are we going to have to cut it in there, or will he be able to maybe take his thumb and push it back into place or something? Or?
Not likely. If you have significant compressive symptoms that have lasted this long, you may indeed be a candidate for a surgical release.
Oh, wonderful. So what is tennis elbow?
Tennis elbow is actually a form of tendonitis and is usually on the other side, on the outside part of your elbow, and relates to inflammation in the tendons of the forearm, the muscles that allow you to lift your wrist toward you, all anchor in the bone on the outer aspect of your elbow, and direct compression over that area is usually quite tender, and people notice that when they go to like lift the jug of milk off the counter, that they have trouble with pain going up their forearm into the outer aspect of their elbow. And this is just actually a form of tendonitis that usually responds to icing and anti-inflammatory agents, splinting. You've seen people wear a tennis elbow strap.
And then tennis elbow heals itself as the months go by?
Most of those get better within a couple of months.
Yeah, see, this isn't happening. And then when I lift things up, it hurts. So that's not a good thing.
It's like time to get it checked out.
A gallon of milk or something, there's great pain, and I really don't want to take Tylenol every 4 hours for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we'll ask for these two pieces tomorrow morning, and here we go. Thanks.
All right, good luck. We'll get one more here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Are there any tests to determine whether one has acid reflux disease?
The history of what individuals describe happening to them is often quite useful in identifying that. But in terms of specific tests, you can do a couple of different things. One is simply an X-ray. You watch stuff go down, and if you see it come back up, that's a pretty good sign of reflux. That's not always present at the time you do the test, so you can sometimes miss that. At the time of endoscopy, when they look down inside, again, they can oftentimes see material coming back up. And thirdly, you can do a pH probe. You can drop a device that measures the degree of acidity in the stomach and the esophagus and record whether at any time during the recording period the pH dropped significantly in the esophagus, indicating that acid was getting up there. So there are really several different ways that this can be evaluated, and depending on your situation, your physician may recommend one or the other.
What's the normal course of treatment when you have it?
Typically, modifying lifestyle changes that can impact whether acid's getting up into your esophagus or not are helpful. The caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, and anti-inflammatory agents should be kept to a minimum. You should not eat and then lay down, because that mechanically simply makes it easier for material in your stomach to get back up into your esophagus. And the use of antacids to try and neutralize and protect the esophagus are not unreasonable. Medications to decrease acid production, and there are a variety of those are often used. And in really stubborn cases, occasionally surgery to try and restore the degree of integrity to the esophagus to protect it from stomach acid getting back up.
Thank you, Doctor.
All right, thanks. This is something that plagues a lot of people. I think we need to form a reflux support group. And of course, when now we know that these medications, the proton pump inhibitors, are now very high in the list of frequently prescribed medications now in this country.
Yes.
And I guess I find myself wondering, is this something new? Do we have more reflux than we had before, or are we simply more aware of it? We've got a name to attach to it now, and we have some maybe a little bit better treatments than we had in the past, so it's just getting more attention.
We definitely have more of it, and a lot of it is we have met the enemy and it is us, and it relates to the types and quantities of food and the degree of obesity that sort of plagues this country. I have a number of patients who, when they finally sort of got their act together and lost weight, their reflux went away. You know, they said, well, you know, I don't go to McDonald's anymore and order the cheeseburger, and I don't have two beers before I lay down to go to bed at night. And, you know, they basically made some significant lifestyle choices to improve their situation and got a lot better. So a lot of this is a function of what we do to ourselves, and a number of individuals can be improved. Now, there are some folks who do all the right things and just have a problem with it, and those are the folks who are going to end up on medication or thinking about surgery.
Okay. Well, there we will leave it this time around. Say thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic. He's with us every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor.